If you want to teleport to 2 years in the future of consumer AI, you want to know what is going to have product market fit, go hang out in the Discords. You'll get a free front row seat to what's going to be mainstream 2 years from now. Still, by the way, the real world usage patterns of how these models are actually used by consumers are extremely misunderstood by the research teams building them. This is the thing. I think ARR is not a very useful metric anymore for progress. But the thing I look for, to be honest with you, is steady state retention. Models are not products, right? And customers don't buy models, they buy solutions.
Anj, I'm super excited for this conversation. I think you and the Andreessen Horowitz team and you personally have been crushing it for the last couple of years with all of some of the best AI startups being backed by you all. I'm curious actually if you want to start with sort of the landscape of where we are with respect to like all the open models. You're on the board of Mistral, worked super closely with them. Sort of like, what's your sense where we are? Like, have things played out the last 2 years how you would have expected them to? Like going back to, I don't know how long ago y'all did the Mistral investment or just like generally got excited about like backing model companies. But I'm curious like how your thinking has evolved and where your sense of where we are.
Sure. The story, I'll give you the, I think it's worth going, rewinding a little, you know, earlier in time, even before the Mistral investment, to give you a sense of why I was so excited about Mistral. And this was back in 2023. I was running in 2022, I was running the platform team at Discord. And so this was the org that was responsible for all the infra that developers use to ship Discord bots, apps, you know, activities, the SDKs, everything that developers need I was on the hook for at Discord. And about 6 months before GPT-4 was put into general access, the OpenAI team sent us like a preview of GPT-4. And they said, hey guys, you know, we love Discord. I think Sam and the executive team, the founders of Discord, had been friends for a long time. They had both, I think Discord had gone through YC a few years earlier, you know, so they kind of knew each other from the SF community and said like, hey, we trained this new model, GPT-4. We don't really know what it's good for. We think it's a lot better than GPT-3 or GPT-3.5. Can you guys actually like dog food being an enterprise customer of the API and tell us what it'd be good for? And I was kind of the resident AI fan. Like I was like compulsive early adopter, partly because I had just worked really closely for a few months before that with the Anthropic guys as an angel investor, and then helping David and the Midjourney guys get Midjourney off the ground as one of our first like apps on the Discord platform. We created a homepage, and Midjourney was the first hero use case we put on there. And so I was the sort of resident prompt engineer and tester, and so everybody else at Discord said, we're too busy dealing with keeping the business going on. You go figure out what is this GPT-4 thing good for? And what we did is like ran what good product teams do, right? Which is you run a few experiments. And one of the experiments we ran was running 100% of inference of about 10% of Discord public servers. So these are community servers where anybody can join, chat, you know, the equivalent of public subreddits, through GPT-4 as an alternative to human content moderation. Because what would happen is in these public servers where thousands of people get together, inevitably you have some bad actors who are trolling each other or violating the community's norms. And what happens is somebody in the community will flag somebody else's message and say, hey, this is violating the server's norms and community rules. And then usually that ticket will get reviewed by some human, right? It's a customer support thing. And we're like, well, that team would love for a tool that could do better automated review of when some message actually violated the community rules or not. And it's actually quite a subtle like task, because it requires natural language interpretation of that community's rules. And we ran these, you know, a 10% treatment of the servers through GPT-4, and the results were basically extraordinary. In a few weeks, retention in those servers, which is a measure of community health, was up by like double digits, 20%+. And for anyone, you know, for you guys, you've been in product, you know this, but the number of product improvements that improve retention by 20%+ double digits is Hall of Fame material. There's like, you can't, you can like, you can't really, you can't, it's super rare, right? In my entire product career, there've been maybe like 12, 13, you know, product improvements of all time that have ever moved retention to that degree, right? So we're like, okay, wait, this is incredible. We've got now this way to make our human content moderation teams way happier and our users way happier because it's improving the health of the servers. So let's rip, let's push to prod, let's go to 100% of production, right, of all servers. And there were three reasons that kept us back from doing that. The first was, it was really expensive. And so it cost about $4 million in credits to run that experiment. It was going to cost $40+ million to run 100% of all servers through that, public servers. And I didn't have $40 million in infra budget lying around that like we hadn't already allocated in our annual forecast. The second thing was it was extraordinarily slow. Like you guys know this, but you know, inference has come a long way. Inference optimization has come a long way. But this back in 2022. Inference was slow, and it would have backed up the real-time messaging queue on the Discord platform by too much. And so we needed to do a ton more systems optimization. We needed faster inference. And then the third thing, and this is really honestly the biggest deal breaker, is that our prompts would just stop working because the team at that point would just do continuous safety training, post-training pushes to the weights. And that would just mean that a bunch of tasks that we were asking GPT-4 to do would just get refused. And so we're like, okay, guys, we're happy to actually pay. We're actually happy to host the weights and run inference optimization ourselves on our own infrastructure. Because you know, at the time, Discord had about 200 million monthly active users. We had a pretty decently large infra team that was great at optimization. But we said, ultimately, we need to be able to control what our users can and cannot do with the model. We can't have you guys just break the prompts, right? We can't have prompt refusals just show up willy-nilly. And so we'd like more control. So can you please give us the weights and let us run it on our infrastructure? And that wasn't a possibility because as you guys know, you know, OpenAI is a closed source model provider, right? And so that's when for me, usually in the arc of computing history, when an enterprise customer or developer needs cheaper, faster, and more control, the solution is pretty well known. You go look for an open source alternative. And we looked around and we literally couldn't find one. And so that's when I think for me, the aha moment was like, okay, for every dollar in proof of concept revenue in the enterprise that we were seeing around AI models at the time, there were probably 10 more dollars waiting for an open source alternative to show up and unlock prod. But there literally was no alternative until everything changed a summer later, which is when Llama came out. And Llama was the first time that there was a GPT-4 equivalent or comparable open source model for the enterprise. And you know, a few months later, the team behind Llama, you know, Guillaume and Tim, who were the co-inventors, left and decided to start Mistral. And so that made the investment much more straightforward because they decided to then go build that, offer cheaper, faster, more control of AI models as a service. And I think, so if you ask to bring it all back to your question, you know, have the last couple of years gone as I expected? Basically, it's gone faster than I expected because we knew that the general arc of computing, like we saw with databases, like we saw with compute, like with storage, with networking, usually the closed source leaders pave the way for new use cases. And that unlocks a bunch of like proof of concept revenue. And then when serious enterprises start deploying, that's when you need cheaper, faster, more control. So like we saw with MySQL and with Databricks, that's when open source usually ends up winning on the Pareto efficiency curve, right? They're not usually the smartest models, but they're the most efficient models, right? And that's what the enterprise wants is cheaper, faster, more control. So that was the thesis behind our $200 million Series A into Mistral, which at the time seemed crazy. But you know, since then, I've been surprised by two things. One is the level of demand from regulated industries for cheaper, faster, more control, right? Defense, healthcare, financial services, especially in Europe, where they're looking for somebody that broadly speaking, they can treat as a sovereign AI provider, right? Where geopolitically, they want an AI solutions provider that's not only open source, but that can run all those workloads locally on-prem for them, right, where their data never leaves their infrastructure. So that's been a way bigger trend, faster than I expected. And I think we have President Trump and the new administration to thank for that. Because in times of instability, countries decide they want infrastructure independence over their own supply chain, over their own local infrastructure. And that's resulted in a huge demand for open source. The second thing, which has accelerated the demand for open source that I didn't expect, is China, right? And DeepSeek and all the amazing work they did, aggressively proving to the world that if nobody else is going to put out frontier open source models, they're happy to, right? And I think that's made it easier for everybody else in the West, who was, I think, being less aggressive than they should have around open source diffusion, to get their head, you know, out of the clouds and be much more aggressive about Apache 2.0 licensing, MIT licensing. So those are the two. Has it gone as I expected? Yes. But there still have been a couple of surprises. Like I did not have DeepSeek on my bingo card, like R1 on my bingo card last year.
I love that. That's I want to come back to the latter point that you're making, but to actually just double click quickly, because the Discord thread was reinvigorating a bunch of brain cells, which I hadn't used in the past couple of years. I don't know if this is public or not, or whether you have data on this, but when the explosion of ChatGPT was happening, all of those users were some very large number of them were also going to Discord because right. It was like the official OpenAI ChatGPT Discord. And there was like this massive explosion. And as you were sort of talking about the Midjourney example, which like the actual product experience for Midjourney, if folks aren't familiar with the historical context, was you would go to Discord. Like that's how you use Midjourney, was like basically only through Discord. And there was a really interesting like social flywheel that sort of made that product experience come to life. And I was just ruminating for a second as you were talking about like what the world would have looked like where I like had ChatGPT like pivoted towards that and just been like, hey, we have, you know, the world's fastest growing Discord, like let's just build our product around this and like go and do something. That obviously seems like a bad idea because ChatGPT is such a successful product now in hindsight. But have you seen this sort of, just to double click on the Discord angle, have there been other like Discord first, like large sort of successful like AI products or like other types of products like that that were sort of built and like housed entirely on Discord? And like have those, like does that still happen today, or are product builders like, I don't know.
Yeah, no, this is a great question. So I'm happy to take you to the Museum of 2022 Discord, which was a wild time on the platform because the developer endpoints and all the UI kit pieces that an AI developer would need to like rapidly prototype a UX on top of a model and deploy to hundreds of millions of people was already live on Discord. And the most savvy product builders like David Holtz at Midjourney like knew that and absolutely rushed towards that. And so Discord in 2022 was this petri dish of a bunch of use cases that we now are seeing, you know, in much more mainstream formats. But obviously, you know, Midjourney text to image found like explosive product market fit on Discord. I think we created this app store front page. We called it the App Directory. And Midjourney was one of the first we put on there. And basically within 7 to 8 months, the company had exploded past, you know, tens of millions in ARR. But in every other modality, this story was going on. So with text to audio, there was a little team that you may have heard of now called 11 Labs, you know, which was tinkering with an audio bot. And they were trying to figure out, hey, do we go consumer, prosumer? They had this open source TTS model that they'd fine tuned. And I remember, you know, I was the DevRel guy, right? So I was on Zoom with Maddie and Peter back then going, look, what is the right way to allow them to start collecting human preference data? Because that's the number one thing you need for the RLHF flywheel, right? You need a product experience that gets you human preference data that then you can use to run RLHF on. And so one of the first most popular audio bots on Discord was an 11 Labs bot where you could literally text it. And it would, in different famous like voices, you know, there was a Morgan Freeman one and so on, you could generate little like 3 to 6 second clips. And it was, people loved it in the servers that they were trying out. So text to image was Midjourney. Text to audio was 11 Labs, which is, you know, now has exploded, is, you know, multi-billion dollar business, you know, hundreds of millions. And in, actually, I don't know if the revenue is public, but well, has found explosive product market fit for that modality, right? in text to video, early on, there were a number of labs that built little text to video bots that exploded in usage. One was actually Pika Labs. I don't know if you've probably heard of Pika. Pika started as a Discord bot before they had a web app. That's how they got their first like 30,000 users. Both 11 was doing interesting stuff, but in audio, but so was Suno, right? Suno started as a Discord bot originally. So a number of services now that have their own like sort of web front ends, like literally all got to their first 20 to 50,000 users and kind of iterated on that core product market fit loop inside of Discord. And so that's how I know all these founders is like, you know, it'd be like 11 p.m. at night. I'd be settling in to sleep in the Mission where we used to live. And my phone would blow up and my wife would be like, okay, who is that? Because the Discord team was very respectful of after hours messaging. They never call me or text me. But if it was one of our devs, they'd just treat me like 24/7 customer support. And it'd be inevitably some founder going, hey, some YouTube video blew up of our text to X bot. And like, our server is maxed out at our 1 million members. Can you pull off the rate limits, please? Because you got to remember, Discord was designed for small groups of friends to play games together, right? So we actually had to re-architect the entire infra service so that it didn't fall over for one simple reason. This is going to, for the product nerds, this is going to be a fun detail. But look, it's mostly implementation detail. But have you guys noticed when you're in Slack or in Discord and you start typing, or somebody else in your group is typing, you can see a little indicator that says Logan is typing or Nolan is typing. And if five people type, right, then you get like Logan, Nolan, and three others are typing. The way that works is every client is sending a message that Nolan is typing to a relay server. And that relay server is then fanning out that message to every other client so everyone can receive that message. Now, when you have 10 people who are typing because they're playing games together or like they're in Fortnite, not a problem. When you have 100,000 people typing to create images together, it crashes the entire CDN, right? So there were these moments where like we hit these scaling, like very real scaling infra issues, because there were all these founders who were like flocking to the platform and prototyping these new AI generative model use cases. And, you know, a few of them ended up becoming, I mean, obviously Midjourney is the poster child for that. But I would say a number of other founders, character AI, similar, like chatbots, RPC bots, role play character bots was like a huge category. Still is, by the way, one of the largest categories on Discord. So if you ever need a cheat code, like if you want to teleport to 2 years in the future of consumer AI, you want to know what is going to have product market fit, go hang out in the Discords. You'll get a free front row seat to what's going to be mainstream 2 years from now. Still, by the way.
I think an interesting thought off that, and it goes back to kind of the point around open source, right? Like you're basically, Discord is your opportunity to build in front of people, get that community, get that feedback, that whole loop, which it seems like is obviously a very big competitive advantage to a lot of the founders that we're speaking with. But I think kind of going back to your point too on like the open source versus closed source / private models, right? Like what, you know, for folks who are building using all of these, it seems like every day there's a new model coming out or a new iteration of a model. You know, I think we were talking about it too before we hopped on camera too, but around reliability or reliable AI, you know, right, for these individuals, how important is it to benchmark how reliable a model is, especially if you're going to take the time and effort to implement it?
Yeah.
Like how are you currently thinking about that or actually executing it?
Yeah. So this is a great question. I'm going to answer your previous question with a story. And then I promise it might seem like I'm meandering for a while, but I promise it'll connect, which is that the reason these bots and these apps took off in Discord is for a simple reason. I think you hinted at it earlier, Logan, which is multiplayer mode. Originally, when the Midjourney team was tinkering on a text to GAN, like a text to image GAN service, you know, David and I have been friends for 10, 15 years. He was a founder of a VR company. My last company was an AR company. So we knew each other from the founder community. We used to play Magic the Gathering on weekends. And one weekend, you know, he was like, you know, Ansh, it's funny, like we've been tinkering on this little website where you can create text to images using GAN and Stable Diffusion. This was when DALL-E 2 was still in closed preview. But we have we're using Discord internally as our Slack, and the internal QA team is generating more images than our like alpha users on the website. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Let's take a look. And as soon as like, you know, within the first prompt on the QA bot, I knew exactly what was going on. Humans were learning we are social animals, right? We're like, we learn by copying each other. And what was the problem with the web app they'd built was it was just this website, kind of like the DALL-E site, where you had a cold bar, like a cold entry bar. And what Midjourney and DALL-E were saying to users was, hey, we compressed all of humanity's visual knowledge into this paintbrush. Here's the paintbrush. Go ham. And people would be like deers in a headlight, right? They'd be paralyzed by analysis, by the blank page paralysis syndrome, where they type cat, dog. But instead, if you drop them into a multiplayer context, like a Discord channel, and one person out of a group of five happened to do something creative where they said, a dog riding a car, and that would spark inspiration for everybody else in the group and go, oh, I'm going to take that prompt and tweak it a little bit. A dog riding a car in the Mission in San Francisco. And that's all, that little bit of social onboarding is all you need to bypass the blank page paralysis syndrome. And that's why retention for Midjourney and engagement was 10 times higher on Discord than their blank page web app. And that's when I said to David, okay, look, you need an instant, that your first 30 seconds of using the generative bot have to be multiplayer. You need to be dropped into a social context where you can immediately see other people playing with the prompts, so then you can tweak them yourself versus being dropped into a solo player web app, right? That is when I realized that it taught me two things. One, that almost every great consumer generative AI use case, it was going to need some kind of social infrastructure for onboarding, right? And the second was that the real world usage patterns of how these models are actually used by consumers are extremely misunderstood by the research teams building them, right? Like the research scientists go, we compressed all of humanity like into this incredible latent representation. Here, go crazy. Here's the model. Like here's the endpoint. Go crazy. And then they're shocked when people don't know what to do with them, right? And that's when I realized you have to understand what these models are good for. What they're reliable at solving, what they're not reliable at solving, you have to evaluate them in context of the real world usage, like literally in the form factor that they belong in, right? That the product market fit exists in. You can't run an MMLU academic benchmark for some NeurIPS conference paper, have it spit out like, oh, this model is like good, is 78% versus GPT 3.5, which is 66% at solving MMLU tasks, and then be surprised later when the model actually fails on a bunch of real world tasks. It's because the evals you ran were completely academic and theoretical. And that's why the Discord, we started using real world usage evals for deployment at Discord when we were building a bunch of these generative model SDKs for our devs. The number one thing that devs would ask us is, hey, Anj, we built this model, how do we test whether this checkpoint is better than the other checkpoint we have? Because often the way scientists work is they'll have like five different checkpoints over a week, right? They do different training runs. They change the like data mix. They change the human preference fine tuning mix. And all that comes out is a checkpoint with a bunch of weights. And they have no idea how reliable one checkpoint is versus the other. And what's crazy about these models, because they're not interpretable, they're black boxes, right? Introducing a simple one line prompt, like a difference in the system prompt, can result in a whole bunch of behavioral differences that you have no idea. And that's what makes these models unreliable, is they're fundamentally black boxes. They're not interpretable. So the spoiler alert, the answer is, well, either you make the black box a clear box, like invent an X-ray to scan the models. And that's what, by the way, got me really excited about investing in Anthropic's seed round when, Dario and Tom, who've been longtime personal friends, gave me a call at the end of 2020. One, they had just published GPT-3. They said, hey, Anj, we think we've discovered scaling laws. We think there's a whole new lab to be built. We'd like to leave OpenAI, and we think there's a whole new lab to be built that treats interpretability, and specifically mechanistic interpretability of these models, as a first-class citizen. That was one of the sort of founding reasons that they left. And so I came on board and I, as a first investor, and helped them, with all the random assortment of things they needed, but to build the whole cloud family now. But early on, one of the big ideas that I fell in love with the Anthropic team was making these black boxes interpretable, because without that, they're just fundamentally unreliable for the most mission critical use cases in our lives. Like you're never gonna, like, sure, you know, chatbots are cool, but if you want them to end up deploying, being deployed in defense and healthcare, in financial services, like the big parts of the economy, we just had to make them more reliable. And the view there was to crack the interpretability problem. Over the last few years, as the ecosystem has matured, I think that we can't really wait for the research of mechanistic interpretability to be solved, because it really is research. It's not sort of solved in an engineering deterministic fashion yet. And the second body of work I've gotten more excited about, to answer your question, Nolan, more directly, is to recreate the real world usage patterns in the evaluation of these models. And that's why I'm a big fan of Ella Marina, right? Which we've talked about, is a nonprofit, is an effort that started as a nonprofit research kind of community out of UC Berkeley, out of Jan Stoica's group. Jan is, kind of godfather of modern systems at Berkeley, set up the LMSys group, co-founded Databricks, you know, years ago. And he realized this independently, like a few years ago, that, hey, all the evals that these systems are being run through are like completely terrible at proxying what their reliability is in the real world. And that's why they started LMSys as this side-by-side eval framework where you can where real users can show up, type their chat query, for example, in the case of text-to-text models, and then literally rank them side-by-side with a blind taste test the way you would with, you know, wine. Like if you ran a blind wine taste test, right? And then you can run pairwise matches across different models to construct a leaderboard, right? Which is how the ELO score of the Arena leaderboard is computed. And I found like that's an extraordinarily better measure for how good these models are in the chat context, for example, than using some academic benchmark like MMLU. Now, the natural like end state of this is every company, every user is going to have their own leaderboard, because the reality is you want a new leaderboard specifically for your prompts, because the reality is Logan probably prompts code models completely differently from you, Nolan, because, you know, you guys have different tasks, you have different preferences. And so today, I think we're still in this primitive era of reliability, because we're just moving from the academic era of benchmarks to like the real world usage evaluation era of Ella Marina. And now as we move to like getting these models actually deployed, especially in pretty mission critical contexts, when governments are asking like, hey, what models do I use for my citizens to interact with around our healthcare services? What models do we deploy in a military context? Like MMLU no longer works as a benchmark. And so what you want is a specific, for example, national security leaderboard that spits out a ranking of these models on national security related tasks, right? That's where I think we're going.
Quick question off that. What are you actually scraping to get those real world use cases? Like how are you getting that lens to actually even put that into some kind of benchmark?
Yeah, this is the beautiful thing about community sites. Look, you can't throw money at product market fit. You have to build a real product loop where people show up, like everyday users who are using these models for their work or for their personal lives, actually want to use your site. And that's the difference between Arena and, you know, a private leaderboard eval service. About a lot, you know, lots of companies like Scale AI and so on run private leaderboard services where they literally pay contractors, right? That's not real world usage. When a contractor is being paid $50 to $100 an hour to rate a model, they're doing it as a job, right? They're trying to get through as many votes as they can in an hour. This is all public data, by the way. Ella Marina, I think you can go and look up their site. They have, they've had 2 million or so, more than 2 million prompts voted on with more than 1 million monthly active users. Those people are just doing it because they find it useful to show up and rank these models side by side for their own purposes. Like they're just everyday programmers who show up, and when a new model is being tested, and you know, Logan's colleagues at Gemini do this all the time, where they'll put up a private checkpoint that's a stealth model, and millions of people want to show up and test these stealth models side by side to figure out which model is better and where the world is going. So it's this very natural organic community that like kind of assembled around this site over the last few years. And I don't think there's some simple answer I have for you on how to recreate it, right? These organic like communities they're not predictable. They show up because there's real value and a relationship that these users build with each other and the developers behind these projects. It's like saying today, if you're like, Anj, what, you know, why don't we just start a Facebook competitor, right? And I'd tell you, cool, but that's, there's 15 years of network effects you're going to have to somehow, you know, outperform. And so, you know, we haven't had a Facebook competitor in years and years because that network effect is so unassailable, right? That it took something like ByteDance creating an entirely new product format called TikTok, right? And then, of course, they don't get me wrong, they spent, ByteDance spent hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising to get TikTok downloaded in the US, you know, 5 years ago. But they only did that after that core new format had product market fit. And that 0-1 phase, that chicken and egg loop, I don't have an easy answer for you on how to recreate that, but I can tell you that Ella Marina has kind of become one of the leading community sites for that, which is why I think Model Labs find it so useful.
Yeah, and how do you, if you want to geek out about Ella Marina for a second, my sort of two questions. One, do you think that it like evolves into like more, like even more of a social experience than it is today, if you sort of had to guess where the value creation was? And then secondly, one of the creative labs teams at Google, I don't know if you saw this experiment, built something called Vibe Check. And it's like, imagine it's Ella Marina, but you're sort of... the prompts are being, the like end outputs are being sort of presented to you instead of like you sort of, and they like show you like three different options instead of you sort of current Ella Marina experience, if folks haven't done it, is like you go and you do your own prompts. So there's no like, you sort of have some of that like blank canvas problem to think about as a user, which is kind of makes sense because you want to do whatever you want to do. But how much do you think like there's an opportunity for that version of the experience where like it's, something's that's presented to you.
Interesting. I've learned the hard way having built products, you know, and this was certainly true during my Discord career, that friction, like small amounts of friction in the workflow consumer products are brutal, right? Consumers are extraordinarily impatient with their time and attention. And introducing even a little bit of friction usually has nonlinear impacts on your retention and engagement, right? If you kind of often, you can sometimes, in most cases, you can lay out a product as a funnel. And if you think about the magic moment of a user at the end of the funnel and then the first time user experience at the beginning of the funnel, anytime you have any friction in the middle, you lose people at each step of the funnel, which is why eventually, you know, first-time founders always ask me, like, "Anj, we're so surprised. Like, we rolled out this app. We had millions of users download it, but we only had like, you know, 23% people come back in week two, like retention." And I'm like, "Yes, because you're do an X-ray on your actual funnel, and what they're only measuring is step one and step final, and what's happening is secretly they're losing, you know, a bunch of people at each part of their product funnel, right? This is not now. It's this is well understood." Anytime anyone goes through this, the first time they ship a product, it's like, you know, the light bulb goes on and then they never design a product the same way again. I haven't tried the Vibe Check experience myself, Logan, so I'm kind of going off of your description, but my knee jerk is that it feels too frictionful relative to an experience like, you know, to go back to Discord. Have you tried the Midjourney SREF kind of implementation where style refs, So Midjourney has figured out that one of the best ways to get people to prompt better images is to create this concept of a style reference, which is you can personalize, but over using the product, you can save, anytime you have a good experience with a prompt, you can save that as a style reference, right? And then you can reuse that style reference later. So I think Midjourney is a good canary in the coal mine for how future products will evolve, where products like Cursor, products like Kriya, you know, Gemini for sure, will actually, ChatGPT is doing this with memory, will start to passively store moments where there was a clear magic moment for you and then reintroduce that to you as a saved prompt template in the future, right? And I think that kind of Vibe Check is much less frictionful because it happens in the organic kind of passive life cycle of a user using the product versus taking you out of what your intent is at the time of using the product and asking you to like triage these vibe check prompts actively. Does that make sense? You want to think about it as cognitive tax. And the more cognitive, the more separate the task is, or the action that you're asking the user to take is from what they showed up to your app to do, the higher the cognitive task, right? And so the trick is like extract the cognitive task into something you can like observe from the natural usage of the product and then reintroduce it in the tiniest way as additional work for the user. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And just to keep geeking out on this point really quick, to maybe expand what I think this angle of the vibe check piece to actually with what you're saying, and then to switch the product space to, well, Nolan and I talked to Eric Simmons, the CEO of Bolt. And like one of the biggest challenges of that aha moment is like the speed of iteration is actually like quite slow because you have to sit there and sort of wait for the models to do all this stuff. And I think about the LM Arena experience where like the, in some sense, they're like economically incentivized to like have, to like put more AI into the world versus if you look at every other product category, there's like an economic disincentive up to a certain level to like add more AI because it makes your you get margin pressure and all this other stuff.
Right.
So I'm super interested in that version of like all of these like future product experiences where you have like different options of like what AI has generated for you because, and like, I think about this for Bolt where like I'm playing around with Bolt or Lovable. I'm like, or even Cursor. I'm like, I wish Cursor did the task three times and then I could sort of just look at all three and be like, I kind of like that one. Let's use that instead.
Yep. Look, we're living in the stone age of product, AI product development in the following sense. Like when we were rolling out the Midjourney SDK for David and team on the Discord platform, one of the key things, you know, we offered them was, look, they were a two-person team, right? So they were like, you don't have more compute than OpenAI. You don't have more researchers than OpenAI. So how are you as a two-person team going to leapfrog OpenAI's DALL-E 2 team, right? And the only answer was, well, we could maybe give you guys more data than OpenAI can because you can move faster than them to ship to millions of people, right? And the kind of data that we could offer them at the time was human preference data where they would, you know, we would allow a user to input a single prompt and you would get four images out. I don't know if you remember this grid setup. And you could choose which image you wanted to upsample. And what we realized then was that when a user chooses to upsample one of the four, that's a huge vote of confidence that they liked that image. So we built the instrumentation funnel so that they could then pipe that event back into their RL pipeline, right? And that was when we said, okay, first of all, I want to say that like that was huge, right? Like having that kind of signal is so much better than not having any signal and just going off of like vibes and tastes of the science team, right? But imagine now that every interaction in Cursor you have can be one of those signals, right? Like the choosing which image to upsample is actually a pretty heavyweight, like heavy-handed signal. But in reality, every interaction you have with Cursor, with Kriya, every time you like select or with Gemini, every time someone actually asks to edit the image with the Gemini, I think it's the 2.5 flash experimental image generation model, right, in the AI studio, that the way the user chooses to instruct edit the image is huge, hugely valuable signal. And so I think we're only now starting to get to the point where Arena, for example, can provide, it's almost like, have you guys watched Minority Report? No. Okay. There's a scene from Minority Report. This, you know, I'm dating myself now, clearly. Old school sci-fi movie. You know, Tom Cruise. There's this scene where he's got this interface up of like 50 different computer screens, and he's able to manipulate all of them with his hands. And what's passively happening is the computer is kind of surfacing for him the most important signals across all these 50 screens that are piping in camera feeds from the whole world. That's what you want product interfaces to feel like for scientists, right? Where they don't have to design some really ham-fisted, ham-handed, high-friction, like rating button, right? Where you like just through the natural usage of the product, you should be able to gather a ton of human preference signals. And that what's beautiful about Arena is it's the only place at scale where you can get human preference signals across different models, right? Because in Gemini, you can only get human preference against Gemini. Whereas what the Gemini team really wants to know is, hey, what is the human preference on when the user loves relying on us versus, I don't know, Mistral for something, right? Versus Black Forest Labs Flux versus DALL-E. Because these models are turning out to be, by the way, different, good at different things, right? So I think that's where you're totally right. Alamarina is positively inclined with its user base and researchers. It's sort of a win-win-win alignment situation, right? Where researchers and labs win if people use these models more on Arena. The users obviously win because they get to try different products out all in one place. And I think the world benefits because it makes measurement of these models way more reliable than like these one-off academic benchmarks. Does that make sense?
You kind of just talked about a small team of two, and Logan, you brought up Eric, which again, Bolt was able to go with a very small team from zero to it was either 15 or 20 million ARR within a few months. Curious, and I feel like it'd be great to get your perspective on this. You know, you're seeing teams that are a lot smaller, able to do a lot more with technology, you know, maybe not looking to raise potentially as much. Like, what are you seeing in the VC space for a lot of these teams that are, again, able to hit the ground running, only takes a few months, get tens of millions of ARR? Like, how does that change your perspective? Does it? And kind of, yeah, how are you evaluating that?
Okay, well, I think ARR, it's amazing how you can enter a room of like 20 founders and ask them, I love this test, you know, ask them all to write down the definition of ARR on an envelope, put in an envelope, pull them all out, put them up on a single page, and you'll see there's literally no definition that will match up, right? This is the thing. I think ARR is not a very useful metric anymore for progress. I do think it's a nice, like, directional fuzzy signal that tells us consumers find extraordinary value when models are wrapped in the right product experience. But the thing I look for, to be honest with you, is steady state retention. Like, once you've shipped a consumer product, which I've had to do, I've had both the pleasure and unfortunate misfortune of having to do, you know, at some decent scale, you realize that the physics of retention are the hardest to move, right? And the thing about ARR is, unless you really dig in and the revenue estimates that the ARR, the recurring revenue, is being driven off aren't one steady state revenue numbers, right? Where if you've ever seen these cohort retention curves, month one is, you know, you start with month zero at 100% of a cohort, right? And then month one is usually at some decay function of that. And then month two is at some decay and so on. And if that curve never asymptotes, then you actually can't count those people as recurring, because they're actually churning, right? And until those curves flatten out, you don't know what your steady state recurring user base even is. And so it's very common for a company, you're right, to like send me a note saying, Anj, we launched this new model. It's incredible. We're at 10 million run rate 2 weeks in. And I go, that's not definitionally possible, because you don't know what your steady state retention is. And run rate, as most people, the tribal knowledge, the way the space usually treats it, is some definition of, you take your last 30 days of revenue and then you multiply it by 12, right? That's absurd if your retention is like 5%. That means 95% of your numbers are overestimated. And so what I will say that we are seeing, I am seeing companies that are smaller many more small teams monetize dramatically more efficiently and faster than non-AI companies. So they are way more Midjourney-esque teams. You know, I had this moment, this like insane moment of seeing these revenue ramps from a 12-person team like Midjourney and Anthropic, you know, 4 years ago. That is becoming much more normal now. But as the Midjourney teams and the Anthropic teams learn the hard way, you can't count your chickens before they hatch, right? ARR is not the right metric to track. What you want to track is steady state retention. And the brutal, the bitter lesson of product physics is that it's extraordinarily hard to move retention by more than a couple percentage points after you've gotten a baseline of what your early cohorts are like. You can count on your hand the number of things in the history of software where a company was able to move its retention by more than double digits above the first natural baseline retention that they had. And this is where you start learning the retention physics of certain categories are just born different. So for example, I mean, this is a fun test to ask you guys. What category do you think in all of software land or in the App Store has the highest weekly active retention?
Social media. It's got to be something.
Games is my guess.
Okay, you guys are not too off. Okay, so the highest retention category is messaging, right? Once you activate a user to become their primary messaging network, the network effects are extraordinary. You're never going to move, right? So this was the beauty, for example, with Discord. When a group of friends had adopted Discord as their primary like messaging tool, like day in, day out, week in, week out, come rain, shine, summer, winter, didn't matter. They just never churned because messaging is a daily, like the physics of messaging is just, it's a daily behavior, right? In contrast, you're totally right, Logan, for games, you see extraordinarily high steady state retention until they're done with the game and then they churn, right? Which is why you see these content, a third of all Apple's revenue in the App Store comes from games that are free to play games, right? Where they charge the whales who are retained for more and more content. But other than those, the only games that retain steady state are social online, MMOs like Roblox, right? Where it becomes almost, it's a hangout spot more than it is a content game. The apps, by the way, that now let me ask you, what apps do you think have the lowest retention?
It's got to be something in fitness.
Yeah,
people get burnt out.
Oh, that's not a bad guess either. Yes, actually, fitness has the lowest retention in February. You can guess why, right? All the like New Year's resolutions. One of the categories that always trips up founders is tools. Tools that are one-off editing tools, right? That are not daily behaviors, that are not weekly behaviors. You know, there are a bunch of these Facetune apps, for example, right? Where you're like, oh, I have, like, I just changed a job. I need to edit my like headshot. So then you download this app, you pay for the like, you know, their premium version to get all the editing tools, and then you never use it again, right? Those tools are really useful, but often have the lowest retention because they're not piggybacking off of a daily behavior, right? Which is why, by the way, ChatGPT is extraordinary because it has turned into daily behavior, right? What OpenAI found is, and what Gemini is finding too, is a new product category that does have daily retention. So if you look at ChatGPT's retention, steady state retention, it's extraordinary. If you look at paid subscriber retention in particular, it's best in class today. I mean, 50-60%+. It was terrible 3-4 years ago. But they've done a really good job, you know, actually getting like, so when actually getting product market fit and getting those cohort curves to plateau. So, long story short, I'm seeing a lot of companies who will often tell me, Andre, we're at 20 million in run rate. And then when you dig in, you know, that what you realize is actually, you can't treat those numbers as ARR, right? Because you don't actually know what the steady state retention is.
Which I will say super quick, Logan, I saw you went off mute, but it kind of makes sense when you think about how many tools and products are coming to market. Like, I'm such a big culprit of, all right, I'll see something in a newsletter. I'll go try 4 tools, you know, probably right. Log in, give them my information, never go back just because solely I forgot about it. Because the next day I'll open up another newsletter and there'll be another one. So I feel like, yeah, makes sense. Very interesting. Go ahead, Logan.
Yeah, I was also just writing, as you were asking the ARR definition, I definitely wrote down MMR times 12. So I'm guilty, guilty as charged. I have a question based on what you were saying about, which is something that I think about a lot in sort of like the developer infrastructure enterprise space around right. Just like what problems model providers are going to solve and like what problems the ecosystem and like model agnostic providers need to solve. Yeah. I think like the LM Arena example is like actually a great example of this where like, it's clear that the value creation is actually when you have all of these things together. I think there's right. A bunch of other like developer tooling examples of this. Do you think about this from like the consumer angle at all? Like, is there like, you know, angles where it, you know, there's certain things that consumer products should be doing versus not. And like, I don't know, I don't know if that analogy tracks, but I think about this from the model provider to developer tooling problem space a lot. And I'm curious if there's like other analogies or parallels in like similar product spaces.
Yeah, look, I actually think of AI usage patterns. I think about AI product physics as kind of following a barbell. Actually, you'll find often the most discerning solo consumers and the largest, most most mission critical enterprises often actually have very similar needs. Let me give you an example. In the case of open source assistance, or in the case of AI assistance, right? What the solo sovereign individual wants is for no closed source provider to know their data or have their personal privacy violated, right? They want fully local inference. They want the models running on their laptop. They want to fine tune it on their specific preferences, on their data, their documents, their text messages, and they want any of that going to any third party. And in the extreme, you could even call these folks like tinfoil hat, you know, paranoid folks. But a lot of these people are my friends. In some ways, I actually care a lot about my privacy too. And so I can empathize why, I can see why there's such explosive demand for local inference with services like Ollama, right? Which is kind of a model agnostic model launcher. You're probably familiar with Ollama, right? On the other side, is if you just wrote down the requirements for why the users of Ollama are so love that product, and you just swapped out, you know, solo user with nation state, like literally the French government, you'd have exactly the same requirements. Literally, the French government is saying we have like, you know, terabytes of citizenry data, like tax filings. We have, you know, actually one of the users of one of the most, I think this is public, customers of Mistral models is SNCF, which is the national rail system of France. And they have a ton of code that's super mission critical code. It literally powers the country's train system. And they want AI, they want their programmers. They have thousands of software engineers who work in SNCF who build the train systems that like run the country's infrastructure. They don't want any third party getting their access to that code base. They don't want any third party getting access to the train schedules, the logistics endpoints. It's a huge cybersecurity problem. And so they literally run Mistral's La Platform and Le Chat on-prem on that data because they want their programmers to get all the goodness of AI code gen, but they have all the same privacy and local like data sovereignty requirements of a tinfoil hat solo consumer sitting in their room trying to run Ollama on their, you know, on their 4090. It's been a surprising realization for me over and over again that it's this sort of barbell demand, right? And that's why, no surprises, when, you know, I don't know if you guys remember when Mixtral came out, right? If you guys remember Mistral 7B or Mixtral, which was their open source mixture of experts model, their like inboxes were full of demand from both solo devs saying, hey, you know, do I need a license from you to run my like waifu bot, you know, with this model? And they were getting inbound from like ministers of IT of different governments saying, hey, we want to deploy this on our infrastructure. And I think that's where consumers and enterprises actually unite at either ends of the spectrum. Now in the middle, I think the reality is especially when it comes to visual services, you know, image, video, where there's a lot of skills required to edit these formats. Like, you know, video editing is a pretty hard thing to do if you guys have ever tried. I think that's where you'll find application developers succeed. And that's where the interface like matters a lot more than the models. And I do think there are some tasks where end users just want like their choice of different model, but to them, models are really not models are not products, right? And customers don't buy models, they buy solutions. And so I think in the case of video, for example, there's a company I work with closely called Luma. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but you know, they make great video models and they've built a ton of video sort of interface level features because a lot of their users need like thoughtful, delightful product features at the interface level. They don't really care about the underlying model. They just want a really great, beautiful video to come out at the other end. right? So those teams are going to succeed in a model agnostic fashion, I think. Does that make sense?
I do hate to do it, but I want to be respectful of everyone's time. We like to ask two ending questions to every podcast. First and foremost, what does your personal tech stack look like?
Oh, man. I've got two GeForce RTX 4090s under my desk. It's a Lambda machine, air-cooled, unfortunately. So I need to swap it out with liquid cooling. Otherwise, it's turned into a heat pump, basically, in my room. So that's my local inference box. And then, you know, I've got a 15-inch MacBook Pro for my on-the-go inference. Gemini, for all things AI, I've got a setup. I've basically built a little like inference rig that runs my queries through four different models side by side. I'm a big fan of the AI Studio inference endpoint, so thank you for that. I use Mistral for all OCR. They've got Bigstral, which is by far the best OCR model. So anytime I'm looking at a pitch deck or a PDF that has visual charts and stuff, I'm sure you guys have noticed, like, a lot of the models suck at analyzing PDFs and visual elements. So Bigstral running in my little my Anj rig is how I do OCR on my docs, and then I run the query through, you know, Claude, Gemini, Claude 3.5. I'm a bigger fan of 3.5 than 3.7. I find 3.7 is a bit of a regression for me. 2.5, and I use I have been a big fan of 4.5, like ChatGPT 4.5, and for that I need to use their inference, because they're trying, like, it has memory about me, so it has context and state, and it's not available to the API. And then for code, it's Cursor, baby. I have switched from 3.7 Sonnet recently to 2.5 as my default in Cursor. We'll see how long it lasts, but congrats, Gemini team. Good job.
And then lastly, we keep it very vague, so interpret as you wish, but one thing you hope happens in 2025 and one thing you hope does not happen in 2025.
I hope that in 2025 we get we solve mechanistic interpretability. Like, we make these black boxes. We actually turn interpretability of these black boxes from a research problem to an engineering problem. What do I not hope? What do I hope doesn't happen? I really hope that we don't lose Taiwan this year.
And on that note, Anj, this was an awesome conversation. This was a ton of fun. We could have done another hour. We'll have you back.
We got this more often, guys. Like, off podcast too. I'm sure we could go so much. I know one we can go longer and spicier off the record. So you got to do that. And where do you guys live these days?